From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, the World Health Organization released its long-awaited Interphone meta-study into the link between cell phones and brain cancer. 10 years and $24 million later, it couldn't find a link, only the vague suggestion of a link. Very unsatisfying, not just because it was inconclusive, but because cell phone technology and usage has radically changed since that data was collected, it's probably irrelevant. We'll report this as an object lesson in how hard science can be to report, but be forewarned, you won't be satisfied either. Dr. Daniel Krusky is one of the authors of the Interphone study.
Overall, the study did not show any clear evidence of an increased risk of either glioma or meningioma. These are the two main types of brain cancer. But in the highest user group for cell phones in the Interphone study, that's the top 10% of cell phone users, who used the phone for more than 1,640 hours cumulatively, we did see a suggestion of an increased risk of glioma, an odds ratio of 1.4, which means a 40% increase relative to the background glioma rate.
Aren't you burying the lead there, that there appeared to be, from your study, a 40% increase in risk if you logged beyond a certain number of hours of cell phone use?
That's what the data would suggest at face value, but if you look at all of the other exposure categories that we had, there was actually no evidence whatsoever of an increase in risk.
I don't understand.
Well, it's just in the highest category of utilization that there was a possible association. There was some concern that the reporting accuracy in that group may not have been perfect. And we also have some questions getting at some of the weaknesses of the study with recall bias and selection bias, some of which we can correct for, some of which we cannot.
In other words, some people may not remember how much they actually use their cell phone.
That's correct. The group did look carefully at that highest decile of cell phone use, noticed that there was a significant increase, and did draw attention to that. But considering the limitations of the data, we're not willing to conclude that that was a causal relationship.
You're accepting the correlation but discounting the causal relationship?
We're taking that as a suggestive correlation that needs to be followed up in the future. We do require continued vigilance with this technology because we haven't unambiguously answered the question. It's a little embarrassing as a scientist to say we've spent 10 years and $25 million and we're not absolutely sure what's going on. But there are limits of science, and we were pushing the limits of science with this large-scale investigation.
One criticism is that the amount of phone use was so much smaller back then.
It does apply to the conditions of use that were in place at the time the Interphone study was designed and executed. If you look at our top 10% of cell phone users, those individuals who use the phone for more than 1,640 hours cumulatively, that averages out over a 10-year period to only a half hour a day, which would be considered perhaps not heavy use by today's standards.
I guess that's the problem. Phones were different back then. Have you produced news we can't use?
Once you start down that road of designing a study to go into the field in the year 2000, you're basically working under conditions that were in place at that time. I think we should take some comfort in the fact that we've done the largest study by far ever conducted on a population basis in 13 countries of cell phone use and cancer risk. Overall, we see no risk. I think that should be comforting from the public health point of view. At the same time, the hints of associations in the high-dose group from Interphone and some similar hints from other studies, I think those suggestions need to be followed up, and I think further research in this area is warranted.
Dr. Krusky, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Dr. Daniel Krusky is one of the authors of the Interphone study. One area in particular he says needs more research is the effect of cell phones on children. No young people were included in the Interphone study, and this is just one of the many complaints Dr. Devra Davis has with it. She says this meta-study also excluded data from more recent studies that looked at more frequent mobile phone users, and which do suggest harmful effects from cell phone use. She says concerns about the dangers of cell phones can actually be found in the fine print of your cell phone manual.
BlackBerry, for example, will tell you to hold the BlackBerry 0.98 inches from the body. T-Mobile says, I believe it's 0.98 inches. The iPhone, it says at least 15 millimeters, parenthesis, 5/8 of an inch away from the body. I surmise that they did this because they understood that if you held the phone directly on the body, you would be exceeding the recommended specific absorption ratio. That's the SAR. And those have been set in concert with recommendations of the FDA and the FCC, but those original SAR calculations were established in 1993 based on the head of a 6-foot-tall man who weighed 200 pounds, having a head that weighed about 11 pounds. Most of the people using cell phones around the world today do not have 11-pound heads. More than half of them are very young.
The kind of radiation that comes from a phone is non-ionizing radiation. That is to say, an electron isn't removed, making an unstable situation. It's merely exciting the atoms, right?
Well, that's right. And we used to think that it was completely innocuous at these very low powers. I certainly thought that for years when I had 2 or 3 cell phones. But in fact, more recent research that's been done in Sweden, in Japan, in Israel, in Finland, has shown that non-ionizing radiation at very, very low power, but with the digital pulsed signal that you get with today's smartphones, that radiation has profound biological effects.
Do you get accused of being a conspiracy theorist, of being part of the, you know, aluminum foil hat brigade?
Oh gosh. No, because you see, at this point, there are very respected scientists at the leading institutions. I mean, does the Finnish Nuclear Radiation Agency sound like a lunatic group?
Some people are shrugging in the control room.
Well, all right. Take a look and see. They advised, most recently in January of this year, that there should be simple precautions in using cell phones.
What would a study have to find for you to be convinced that cell phones are safe?
We would need 30 more years to see no excess risk of brain cancer. That's what we need. The Europeans are going to do exactly that, a 30-year study, and that study is going to follow people carefully and see what their cell phone habits are, and at the end of that study, you'll have an answer.
Well, except the phones will continue to change, so you're going to run into the same problems in the next 30 years, at least 100 times worse than there were in the last 10.
You know, you're raising questions I really can't answer for you, but I can tell you this. I would like the government to use some of that funds that they collect every month for cell phones to fund independent research. Why did the United States of America not participate in the world's largest study of brain cancer and cell phones? Is it because the question is totally resolved? I don't think so.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
Dr. Deborah Davis is the author of Disconnect, due out in September, and the founder of the Environmental Health Trust. James Geary wrote about the health consequences of cell phones earlier this year in Popular Science magazine. Months ago, he predicted that this study would indeed solve nothing. James, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
So let's look at some of the headlines. No conclusive link between mobile phones and cancer. Study shows more research is needed. Study shows small increase in brain cancer.
Well, unfortunately, all those headlines are true. And equally unfortunately, all those headlines are incomplete.
But let's face it, the study isn't helping the situation very much. Part of the problem is trying to prove a negative. If a study doesn't find a clear connection, that could mean that there is, in fact, no connection, or it could mean that the study wasn't conducted very well or wasn't looking for the right thing or wasn't big enough.
Yeah, I think you're right. If you read the Interphone paper itself, probably half, if not two-thirds of the paper, it was an explanation of why these results are unreliable rather than what the results actually were. But that's not due to incompetence on the part of the researchers. It has to do with the fact that the study itself was initiated more than 10 years ago. And so the technology was different and the people using it were different.
I know the industry paid in part for the Interphone study, and I wonder how big was the industry's role in crafting the message either of the study or around the study?
There are many people who, you know, believe there is a vast conspiracy to cover up the scientific research that suggests there is a risk from cell phone radiation, and the main culprits behind that alleged cover-up are obviously the cell phone makers themselves. And having spoken with cell phone manufacturers, many, if not all of them, fund these studies through a sort of blind trust. They give money to an organization, and that organization then funds studies without any kind of input or knowledge of the cell phone makers. I mean, obviously, that doesn't mean there is no influence.
What about a PR effort, like the junk science organizations that were created by the tobacco industry?
Well, there's obviously a huge PR effort going on, but the fact is that most of the studies are on their side. Most studies suggest there is not a correlation. The scientists whom I interviewed who did believe there could be a risk, none of them said cell phones cause brain cancer. They don't believe that. What they did suggest were that there could be mechanisms that we don't understand whereby cell phone radiation could sort of damage the immune system or cause DNA breaks that could lead to a weakened immune system, that combined with other environmental factors could have a cumulative effect. And that is what we should be studying and not looking at a very, very small subset of that question, do cell phones cause brain cancer? Because most of the evidence suggests that they do not. But there are enough indications and enough respectable, reliable studies to suggest that there could be something going on. And that, in my opinion, needs to be explained in a way that does not exaggerate the risk or the safety of what's going on.
Where do you wear your cell phone?
I don't carry it on my body. I use it maybe two or three times a day, and probably half the time I'm texting rather than talking. I think they're very useful and fun devices. But exactly because they're so useful and so ubiquitous, I think we really need to do the research and find out what's going on with them, if anything.
James, thank you very much.
Thank you.
James Geary is an author and contributor to Popular Science magazine.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Last month, a former senior official at the National Security Agency pleaded not guilty to 10 counts related to an investigation of leaks to a Baltimore Sun reporter. It was only briefly in the news, but if convicted, the former NSA official would be the second person convicted of leaking during President Obama's term in office. That's a lot when you consider that these prosecutions are extremely rare. In 2005, the New York Times faced an investigation for printing classified information about the National Security Agency's secret warrantless wiretapping of phone calls and email traffic between suspected al-Qaeda operatives and American citizens. The Times held the scoop for a year, publishing it only when its reporter, James Risen, was about to reveal it in a book. The story and its timing led to accusations that the paper had self-interestedly, unpatriotically, and possibly illegally hindered the war on terror. Among the critics was Gabriel Schoenfeld, a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute in Washington, D.C., who said in Commentary magazine that the Times had overstepped its First Amendment rights and should face prosecution for publishing such destructive national security material. That piece inspired Schoenfeld's new book, Necessary Secrets, National Security, Media, and the Rule of Law, in which Schoenfeld makes the case that leaks can be deeply destructive by citing the history of consequential disclosures. His narrative begins with the Founding Fathers, who both affirmed free speech and agreed that not all information should be free.
The various Continental Congresses were conducted in secrecy. They really understood that we could not provide information that would help the British. The Constitution itself was drafted in secret to keep the members of the Constitutional Convention from being swayed by public opinion. Secrecy has a long and honorable history in our republic.
The Black Chamber affair. Tell me about that.
Herbert O. Yardley, one of America's greatest cryptographers in the 1920s, helped the United States break the Japanese codes, among other foreign government codes. By the late 20s, early 30s, he was out of a job, but he knew all of the secrets of American cryptography, and he compiled them all and wrote a book about them, and he spilled the secrets. The book was very well received here, but in Japan, it caused an absolute furor and provoked the Japanese military to invest heavily in cryptography over the course of the 1930s. And the speed with which our code breakers could break their codes, it slowed down. And by the time Pearl Harbor came along, we could not read most of their military traffic. It was encrypted in a way we couldn't penetrate. And part of the blame for that has to be laid on this leak by Herbert O. Yardley.
There's another story you tell of which I'd only been vaguely familiar, and it concerns Colonel Robert McCormick, who was, I think, founder and editor of the Chicago Tribune from the 20s into the 50s, and was a real FDR hater.
Well, there were two major leaks published during World War II under his editorship and ownership of the Chicago Tribune. First, he revealed, this was December 5th, 1941.
2 days before Pearl Harbor.
A plan called Rainbow Five, U.S. war plans for Europe. And this had been leaked to him by an isolationist Republican senator, Senator Wheeler. Roosevelt had promised not to take America into the war, and this was designed to show Roosevelt's hypocrisy. Adolf Hitler read it, and it was one of the factors right after the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor that prompted Hitler to declare war on the United States. 6 months later, the Chicago Tribune went on to publish a story right after the Battle of Midway, strongly suggesting that the United States had won that decisive naval victory because we were reading Japanese codes. If the Japanese had taken the story seriously, we would have been left blind and deaf in the Pacific. Thousands of American soldiers, possibly tens of thousands, countless civilians would have perished if the war would have been prolonged. We were extremely lucky. The Japanese, for some reason, did not take the story seriously. They did not change their codes. The Justice Department actually initiated a prosecution, impaneled a grand jury to hear evidence against the Chicago Tribune, the only time that's ever happened with a newspaper in our entire history. But they decided to stop the proceedings precisely because the War Department had reported back to them that they were anxious not to, to draw even further attention to the story.
With very few exceptions, the government has not prosecuted whistleblowers, publications, or anybody else for what might have been deemed explicit violations of statutes governing classified information. Why is that?
Well, first and foremost, because we're an open society, and that's a wonderful thing. And also, it's difficult to prosecute in many of these cases. There have been only three successful prosecutions of leakers in our entire history, one under Reagan, one under George W. Bush, and one under Barack Obama. And now Barack Obama has – the Justice Department has initiated the second, a senior official at the National Security Agency who leaked information to the Baltimore Sun. And so if this man, Thomas Drake, is convicted, President Obama would become the first president to send two leakers to prison under his watch in office as president.
In the immediate aftermath of a leak is often called damaging, injurious, creating a clear and present danger and so forth. Often turns out to be just so much huffing and puffing. The boy has cried wolf so often, it's understandable that the default assumption when the protests of breached national security are made is that there's no there there.
There are cases where the government has plainly lied or vastly overstated the damage of leaked materials. And I think that the Nixon administration, in a way, poisoned the well for all future administrations. In the Pentagon Papers case, declaring to the courts that exceptionally grave damage would follow the publication. It turned out that it was all historical material. It didn't compromise ongoing intelligence operations. But we've moved forward to a very new situation where newspapers are publishing information that is ongoing and current operational intelligence, not historical materials like in the Pentagon Papers. So when senior government officials like General Hayden say that their damage has been severe, I think we should take them at their word.
Let's return to the story that began this this exploration for you, the NSA story revealing the wiretaps without a warrant of hundreds or thousands of American citizens. Now, you make a case that this was a blow to operational security, and it may well have been. But it also was about a program of dubious legality at the time. Wasn't it the New York Times' duty to reveal this program once it understood that it was taking place?
No, I don't think it was its duty, and I don't think the program was an illegal program. Of course, there's debate about that today, and people of goodwill disagree. But the fact is that Congress had been briefed on this program 12 times, And no one in Congress, the Gang of Eight, or the ranking officials in Congress and both parties objected to it on any occasion. One of them raised a question about it.
That was Senator Jay Rockefeller.
Correct. He wrote a letter to the vice president and he put a copy in his safe. Not exactly the behavior of a passionate objector to the program. And there's been no indication of any abuses of civil liberties because of this. This was a counterterrorism program designed to keep us safe.
Just a few months after revealing the wiretapping program, Risen and Lichtblau came back with a story talking about another program that tracked terrorist channels of funding through their SWIFT transactions. That's the Belgian clearinghouse for wire transfers of funds. And told Al-Qaeda and everybody else exactly how we were going about that. Flipped you out.
That's right. It did. And in the case of the NSA wiretapping story, the Times said at least, well, there's a debate within the government about the legality of this program. But in this instance, there really was no such debate. The program was just black letter law legal. Eric Lichtblau, one of the reporters, said, above all, and this is a quote, he said, above all, it was an interesting yarn. That's an utterly trivial justification for publishing a story that damaged our ability to track Al-Qaeda. Attorney General Michael Mukasey has called this kind of journalism intelliporn, the publication of intelligence secrets to titillate the public, and for no other reason.
Okay, let's just say you're right, that it was published because it was a scoop and for no other reason. And as you lay out in the book, it's very difficult for the government to prosecute cases, not only on First Amendment grounds, but just because of all the corollary information that gets revealed during the litigation of the case. And because of the political blowback of prosecuting respected news organizations. But we've also established that the government overclassifies and exaggerates every single whistleblowing incident and the consequences thereof. Where does that leave us?
We really are stuck. On the one hand, we do want the press to have discretion to publish secrets precisely because there is overclassification and misclassification. On the other hand, we do want the government to be in a position to say, no, what you've done here goes too far. And there are statutes on the books that protect certain classes of information like cryptography, like the design of nuclear weapons, like the identities of intelligence agents.
I should say that my greater issue with your book is that it constructs a straw man based on the supposition that the press somehow believes that it's always okay to print whatever it learns because it can. But I don't think that's true. The press wouldn't reveal, say, the timing and location of the invasion of Europe, D-Day. It wouldn't ordinarily out CIA officers or agents. It wouldn't reveal military codes. There are, in fact, established protocols for working with the government when these stories arise to determine the stakes of revealing certain information.
I agree with that the press is not reckless in every instance and that they do make an effort to consult with the government. But what concerns me is these two specific cases where, in the face of very strenuous government objections, you had ranking Democrats like Lee Hamilton, co-chair of the 9/11 Commission, telling the Times, do not publish this. And when those particular areas are violated, I think the government can and should prosecute journalists who trespass on the public's right not to know. And the public's right not to know is something that's rarely spoken about, let alone defended. But it's perfectly obvious why we don't want to know certain things that our government is doing. It's because if we know those things, our adversaries know them as well.
All right, Gabriel, thank you very much.
My pleasure. It was fun.
Gabriel Schoenfeld is senior fellow at the Hudson Institute in Washington and author of Necessary Secrets, National Security, the Media, and the Rule of Law.
When I get online, I log into Facebook, click on your profile, and I take a look. I friended you over 3 days ago, but when I see if you accept it, it still says no. I check out your mini feed.
In the past couple of weeks, criticism of Facebook's privacy policies has reached a fever pitch.
Facebook facing a growing privacy backlash. Is it an existential moment for the company?
A new feature on Facebook is raising concerns over privacy on the social network used by 400 million users.
You have a lack of leadership at your company when it comes to privacy, and you have a glib and reckless approach to people's privacy.
That last clip was internet entrepreneur Jason Calacanis way back in December of last year with a message to Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg. Facebook came under renewed fire recently after it announced that it would share information culled from people's Facebook profiles with third-party sites like Yelp and Pandora. This merely piled on the growing fear that Facebook shares too much user information by default, mines user info for data, and changes its privacy settings without adequate disclosure. Shortly after the latest announcement, a coalition of consumer groups and New York Senator Charles Schumer petitioned the Federal Trade Commission to address Facebook's privacy settings. According to Wired.com blogger Ryan Singel, the backlash has been building momentum for quite some time, largely because Facebook seems to be continually moving the goalposts of its users' default privacy settings.
Before, the defaults were only your friends and family could see your information. Now, almost everything you put online, Facebook wants you to make that public, and you have to go into their Byzantine system of privacy controls in order to turn that off.
The New York Times noted not long ago that you had to click through 50 pages to set your privacy settings on Facebook.
I'll give Facebook some credit. The complicatedness means there's a lot of choices. But their privacy policy has also grown to be longer than the U.S. Constitution, which the Times also pointed out.
I guess the point here is that if your data is public, they can monetize the data and thereby keep this service free.
There's not a whole lot of money in just letting people share photos and status updates with their friends, but there is a lot of money in knowing what brands you like and following you around the web. Facebook is aiming to become the biggest display advertiser on the internet because they're going to be able to target ads to you based on the things you've told them.
And I guess the person who is most excited about this prospect is Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg, who argues endlessly for more and more openness on the part of Facebook users.
The web is at a really important turning point right now. Up until recently, the default on the web has been that most things aren't social, and most things don't use your real identity. We're building towards a web where the default is social. Every application and product will be designed from the ground up to use real identity and friends.
Mark Zuckerberg likes to say that Facebook is just reflecting the changing privacy norms of the public. But Facebook is, I believe, forging that change, not so much reflecting it. I think it's a little self-serving of him to say that, you know, we've all become more public people. A large part of that has to do with default settings that Facebook gives us. We're sort of being pushed into revealing more information. And now that Facebook is the place that these conversations happen, we kind of have to buy into that bargain just to be part of the conversation.
So where are we with regard to alternatives to Facebook?
I really like what One Social Web is doing. The way that it works is decentralized. So if I want to communicate with the people who like Wired.com where I write, then there's a little section on Wired.com that has people's photographs and pictures and profiles, and I can do the updates there. And it doesn't actually have to flow through Facebook. I think what Facebook's shown us is that we all want to be part of more conversations. I just think that an open alternative needs to make it so that our data doesn't flow through one mega corporation.
Fundamentally, is the furor being raised by a niche group of geeks that are in revolt? And you're one of the geeks, by the way, that I'm referring to here.
Oh, I'm certainly one of the geeks.
I mean, it's often been said that the average user will choose convenience over privacy every time.
There always is going to be that sort of lead group, but I think this lead group is telling us generally people are starting to feel uncomfortable with the size that Facebook has gotten to. It's hurting Facebook because they have these grand ambitions, right? They don't just want to be the place that you share information with your friends. They really want to be the center of your digital identity online, and that's freaking people out, even though they find it useful.
What's your opinion of Zuckerberg?
He's a really interesting character. There's a book about to come out by David Kirkpatrick, I believe, from Fortune magazine. The excerpts that have come out have been fascinating. For instance, Microsoft came along and told Facebook they'd be happy to buy it for $15 billion. And Mark Zuckerberg said no. And then they came back and they said, we'll buy it over a period of 5 years, so we'll let you stay in control. He said no again. This isn't about the money, and he really wants to sort of change the world, and he really wants that Facebook page to be the place that people define themselves to everyone else online. On Tuesday, Facebook's public policy director, Tim Serispani, said something that was, I think, a bit of a slip when he said that the personalization that Facebook has offered to all the websites on the internet, that they can add these like buttons or add profile pictures from Facebook, he called that an extraordinary gift to the public. I think they really think that they're doing this amazing thing for the public, and we're not thankful enough.
And the gift to the public is the fact that their information can be shared with so many vendors out there.
I think they think this is an amazing gift, that from now on, every website you're going to go to is going to pull in all this information about what you like and what your friends like, and allow those sites to personalize your experience based on that information. It's not clear the public thinks of that as an extraordinary gift, or they just think that might be a little bit creepy.
Ryan, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on.
Ryan Singel is a staff writer for the Threat Level blog and the Epicenter blog on Wired.com.
You wanna be my friend on Facebook.
Coming up, building ramps for the disabled to cyberspace.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from LendingTree, committed to helping people control their financial destiny with innovative tools and personalized advice at LendingTree.com. The Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at MelvilleTrust.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, supporting Games for Health, using video games to promote health innovations at rwjf.org/pioneer. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. The more central the internet becomes to our social and work lives, the greater the hardship for people who cannot access it. Usually, when we talk about people on the wrong side of the so-called digital divide, we talk about class issues, people who don't have internet access because they can't afford it. But there is another digital divide that's in some ways trickier to bridge, disability. That's the problem Sharon Rush and Desiree Sturdivant are working on. Their organization, Nobility, advocates for disabled people's access to the internet. Mainly, they try to raise awareness about the technology that disabled people can use to get online. They try to let disabled users know the technology is out there, and they try to teach programmers to incorporate those accessibility features into their sites. For instance, Sturdivant, who is blind, accesses the internet using software that reads the content of web pages aloud in a fast-talking, digitized voice.
Mobility, accessibility consultants, trainers, and advocates. Graphic mobility. Same page, link, skip the main content. Search, edit, site search button, list of items.
To Sturdivant, navigating the web using this sped-up text-to-speech software is no problem. The only sites she can't use are those that just aren't coded for her software. In that case, all she hears is a garbled mess. For instance, here's the website for a dance school in Texas, rendered pretty much indecipherable.
Joyce Willett School of Dance Windows Internet Explorer. Flash movie start. Joyce Willett. Unlabeled 12 button. 3 button. 15 button.
So in this instance, there's a bunch of buttons on here that are not labeled.
Mm-hmm.
So, Bob, if you or I were looking at the website that Desiree's listening to, we would see each of the buttons has a mark on it that says schedule, performances, sign up for lessons, our staff. But when these are incorrectly coded, the navigation has no meaning to someone who doesn't see it.
Yeah, I'd have to call them and say, please help me.
Desiree, as you surf the web, what percentage of websites are accessible to you, and what percent give you the kind of garbled response that we just heard?
Probably 75% I can get on now.
And is it a quick fix? Is it easy for, let's say, WNYC, if we are not compatible with the software that you have, to make the changes? Is it a multi-million dollar enterprise or somewhere in between what?
Oh, Bob, that is such a hard question because it depends entirely on the programming environment, the level of awareness. As we have these dynamic sites, there are many more complex programming issues that take a little more education. But for most simple HTML websites, if you include accessibility at the very beginning, there's virtually no additional cost.
Now, we've been discussing visual impairments because that's Desiree's situation, but there are a whole host of other disabilities, and I wonder what kind of accommodations are made for them. Can you take down a list?
Sure. For people who have mobility impairments, and we're seeing more and more of that kind of disability as soldiers return from war. Maybe they've lost a hand. Maybe they don't use the mouse at all. So you want to have keyboard access because many of these assistive technologies are mapped to the keyboard. Also, we notice increasingly people stream your show and the radio, and there are audio components of the videos that are online on YouTube. So for those elements, you want to think about your deaf users, and you'd want to have things captioned, or you'd want at least to have a transcript available. I think between blindness, mobility impairments, and deafness, you cover the major areas. There are also issues around cognitive disabilities that are relevant in educational settings.
I'm confused on this point. Now, I know the government has a fairly wide berth in mandating physical improvements in public space that have pretty much become standard, not just in government buildings, but in all public places. Is the internet deemed for the purposes of government mandate a public space that the government can say to a retailer or some other website that you're simply not in compliance and you'd best start to comply?
Well, that's the question. The government has not yet made it quite that explicit. Section 508 of the Rehabilitation Act, which defines some standards for web accessibility, still only explicitly governs the websites of federal agencies. There hasn't been a definitive statement that says absolutely public websites must do this. The principles of the Americans with Disabilities Act can only be supported if we make those regulations explicit.
If you could wave your hand, Desiree, and make something happen in the name of greater accessibility, what would it be?
The disabled population is growing every day. To be able to kind of make people aware that just because you don't have a disability right now doesn't mean that you won't someday or you won't have a loved one that's affected. So to bring awareness into everybody and make them understand the importance of accessibility and access to technology.
And, you know, we're not alone. Obviously, the internet is global, and the European Union has adopted the Web Content Accessibility Guidelines from the World Wide Web Consortium. It's a global movement that understands if we are to have modern society, we have to have equitable access to information.
Well, Desiree Sharon, thank you very, very much.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us. It was great to be here.
Sharon Rush is the co-founder and executive director of Nobility, and Desiree Sturtevant is an accessibility experience specialist for the same organization, which is headquartered in Austin, Texas.
A recent report by the National Federation of the Blind found that fewer than 10% of the 1.3 million legally blind Americans now read Braille. Half a century ago, half of America's blind could run their fingers over coded bumps embossed on thick sheets of paper and understand their meaning. Rachel Aviv is a Rosalind Carter Fellow for Mental Health Journalism with the Carter Center, whose article, Listening to Braille, appeared earlier this year in the New York Times Magazine. Rachel, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
When Braille was created in the 19th century, it was considered a great boon to the blind. In your piece, you quoted Helen Keller. She said, with his godlike courage, Braille built a firm stairway for millions of sense-crippled human beings to climb from hopeless darkness to the mind eternal.
He was a student at the Royal Institute for the Blind in the 1820s. At that point, you learned how to perform menial labor. At home, he had made shapes of letters from nails, and he wanted to find a way that you could replicate. And so there was a presentation at the school by a French officer who had developed a system called night writing. And it was a way for soldiers to communicate in the dark. And he adapted that and made it easier to read so each letter could fit under the pad of a fingertip.
And obviously, it was such a print-driven society that the context demanded some way to join in. But now the context has changed.
Well, at that time, if you were blind, it really also meant that you were intellectually isolated. And in the 1950s, if you didn't know Braille, you still were intellectually isolated. You had no way of accessing the print culture. But today, it's not as simple, and it's continually evolved. First, there were books on tape in the 80s, and then in the 90s, audiobooks. And today, all sorts of text-to-speech software, and even little reading machines. You can hold them up to a menu, for instance, and it will take a picture of the menu and then read the text aloud. So it just keeps evolving.
Media theorist Neil Postman wrote that written language enabled us to think more deeply and with much more complexity. Does current research bear that out?
Well, there was a really interesting study of two groups of blind children. One group had grown up learning Braille, and the other group had grown up using audio technology. And the authors of that study said that there was a significant difference in not just the way that they wrote, but the way that they seemed to think. And they referenced theorist Walter Ung, who writes that the act of seeing our own words and then tweaking them and rewriting them, and in that process, rethinking, really creates a new kind of cognitive style. So they said that the students who didn't learn Braille, it was as if they had shaken up their ideas in a container and then thrown them out on a piece of paper, and that there was really no clear organization and it lacked the kind of complexity that they saw in the students who had learned Braille. People who don't know Braille can't really take notes, can't edit your own writing, and you can't edit your own thoughts. And that's a really significant part of the way that people learn to think.
I wonder, after you wrote your piece, whether you were subject to any charges of cultural bias. Many deaf people see themselves as members of a different culture. They don't want to make accommodations to the hearing world. Is Braille seen by some people as a kind of capitulation to visual hegemony or something like that?
Oh, I actually think it would be the opposite. Braille represents blind liberation in a way, because until the 1800s, until there was Braille, they didn't have a real social function. They couldn't participate. And so Braille represents that move, that transition to participating in society in a more equal way. It's a political symbol as well as a practical tool.
So where do things stand now? Is Braille a dying language?
Braille is not necessarily dying, but if you take the threats to print books and you sort of make a caricature of them, those are the threats to Braille books. Creating Braille books is extremely labor-intensive. They're incredibly bulky. For instance, the Harry Potter series comes in 59 volumes, and they're all almost a foot tall.
Well, I guess you don't have to use paper. I mean, you could use sheets of plastic.
Well, there are Braille computers, which look like little shoeboxes, and you run your finger along the bottom of the computer, and you get one line of text at a time. But those are extremely expensive. They're $4,000 or $5,000. Going back to the question about the political aspect, I think that it's easy to think that technology will always make things easier and that blindness will become less and less of a disability. But I think there's a lot of nostalgia for this earlier era.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Rachel Aviv is a Roslyn Carter Fellow for Mental Health Journalism with the Carter Center, whose article Listening to Braille appeared earlier this year in the New York Times Magazine.
On the website ablegamers.com, video games are rated and reviewed not only for how much fun they are, but by how accessible they are for users who have mobility, visual, or hearing impairments. The site, founded by disabled veteran Mark Barlett and written by gamers with a variety of disabilities, quickly became a success, drawing more than 100,000 readers a month and filling a niche that most in the gaming industry didn't even know existed. Next week, as part of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation's Games for Health conference, Barlett will host the third annual Game Accessibility Day. Mark, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Disabilities are sliced and diced in many, many different ways, and it may not be cost-effective to adapt every game for every category of impairment.
Well, that's why we've really kind of published a top 10 of things that are best practices. A game that was very popular here as of late, Dragon Age, is almost a perfect example of what an accessible game should look like, and it's very commercially successful as well. It's fully closed captioned. You can pause it at any moment and queue up your moves, which is great for someone with a cognitive disability or a mobility disability where they might need a little more time and are not as quick on the mouse as other people would be. Their closed captioning was actually multiple levels. You could turn it on to just give you the characters, and you could also turn it on to give you ambient sounds, which is just amazing. It had colorblind components in it that made parts of it which were color sensitive also have symbols that went along with it so that the 1 in 7 males in the United States who are colorblind had no problems playing it. So if you use good best practices in standard game development, a lot of the disabled population can be able to play the game.
You, for example, have mobility problems. You have difficulty walking because of nerve damage sustained in the military.
Correct.
You can't play football, but you can play Madden football.
Not very well.
But when you're streaking down the sideline, is there some sort of special vicarious thrill that you get that maybe the able-bodied do not?
One of my good friends and the associate editor of ablegamers.com has a muscular dystrophy called SMA, spinal muscular atrophy, and it's a terrible disease. But he plays World of Warcraft and is just completely free and can run and jump and fight monsters and things that you can't do in real life anyway, but he could never do if they were running around. So I think that there is something really liberating that video games give the disabled market that a lot of able-bodied people probably take for granted.
So you're about to host the third Games Accessibility Day. Tell me who the speakers are at an event like this.
Well, Chuck Bergen is the CEO of Vitri Inc., who actually did something amazing. They went to EA.
That's Electronic Arts. That's the big gorilla of video game publishing.
Correct. And license some of EA's software. EA makes Madden and makes Tiger Woods Golf and some of these really great sports games, and actually adapted the game specifically for the physically disabled, cognitively disabled, and he's had an amazing success at the VA hospitals where some of our men and women have come back in some pretty bad shape, and the impact that he's making just blows my mind.
And what about Rock Band?
Just for full disclosure, Rock Band has a very special place in my heart because the CEO of Rock Band was one of the first people to actually write a check to the Able Gamers Foundation and said, hey, turn this into something really real. So Rock Vive, a university project, are bringing Rock Band to people with visual impairments.
And how can it be fitted for the use by the blind?
Well, what they've done is they've put electrodes on the arms of the gamer and sent a little electrical pulses to indicate what action needs to be taking place on the actual electric guitar. So they feel the notes on the screen versus see the notes on the screen.
Whoa.
It's pretty amazing stuff.
Mark, I asked you about disabled people enjoying the fantasy of being not just able-bodied but extremely able-bodied like a professional football player. I wonder if you get involved in the reverse, games that allow the non-disabled to experience life with a substantial impairment.
One of the great things that we're doing at Games for Health is we're running our Able Gamers Accessibility Arcade. And what we do there is we have a lot of technology that is used by the community to help them game. And we actually set that technology up and we, you know, have Xboxes and racing games that you play with your chin. And you have what's called a sip and puff switch, which is a straw hooked to a switch, and you blow into the straw or you suck into the straw, and that's your gas pedal and your brake pedal, and you play the entire game with a straw in your mouth and your chin, and it's an off-the-shelf racing game.
We've been talking about people with physical disabilities, but there's another category of special gamers, and that's people who are just old.
11% of households that are headed by people 65 and older have gaming consoles in their house. 11%. I mean, that's up tremendously from like 2% only 10 years ago.
Bernice, where are my game controllers? I'm sorry. Go ahead, Mark.
They're by the reading glasses. Well, I mean, there's news right now of nursing homes who are bringing in Wii, because what's great about some of the games that we have come out with is they're games that older people understand. They've bowled before. So you show them that they can actually make the actions of bowling. And some of that technology fear just kind of drops off the face of the earth because there's something that they can truly understand. But beyond that, you've got games and Facebook that a lot of what we like to call the gray gamers are enjoying. You have World of Warcraft and some of the multimedia online games that are being adopted by communities because they can socialize and they can be comfortable in their own home still. And you can't break a hip in World of Warcraft.
Well, Mark, I very much appreciate your joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Mark Bartlett is president of the Able Gamers Foundation and founder of ablegamers.com and ablegamers.org.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, Nazanin Rafsanjani, and PJ Vogt, with more help from Alex Goldman, Lynn Davis, and Peter Henderson, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Michael Rayfield.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program, find transcripts, and email us at onthemedia.org and subscribe to our free podcast on iTunes. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
This is Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, the Science Friday team has been reporting high-quality science and technology news, making science fun for curious people by covering everything from the outer reaches of space to the rapidly changing world of AI to the tiniest microbes in our bodies. Audiences trust our show because they know we're driven by a mission to inform and serve listeners first and foremost with important news they won't get anywhere else. And our sponsors benefit from that halo effect. For more information on becoming a sponsor, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.